get it into their heads that a unionist could be gay, atheist, pro-choice, pro-same-sex marriage, Catholic, and from any ethnic background or race. That's the message from political commentator Alex Kane, who has been writing in the newsletter. The former Ulster Unionist Director of Communications says it's not too late to reinvent unionism. He's with me this morning. Good morning to you, Alex.
Morning, Stephen.
Good morning. And the Independent Unionist Councillor Henry Riley with me today too. Good morning to you, Henry.
Good morning, Stephen.
Good morning.
Hi, Henry.
So, Alex, before we get into this, where were we at post the deal that was never a deal, the draft that didn't exist, but we've seen it? Where are we at?
Well, I think we're in a huge mess. Well, unionism, I think we're all in a huge mess, Stephen, because this is not just an us and them in the sense that it's bad for one party. The fact they failed to get a deal is very bad for Northern Ireland. The fact that the deal, for whatever reason, was talked up in the last few days, that people genuinely believed that something was coming after months of what looked like standoff and loggerhead and bitterness, suddenly thought, well, maybe these guys are going to surprise us. So I think the shockwave that went through Northern Ireland was not just in the political circles, Stephen, it was just that sense, and I got it, and you got it, and anyone who's involved in this business will have got it, people saying, they're just incapable. They just cannot sort anything out. That was the real damage of that. In terms of if you're asking me specifically the damage it did to the DUP, I think it gave the perception that the DUP, who are usually, as I said in yesterday's piece as well, DUP are usually very good at negotiation. For the past 20 years, they've taken their people gently. They've made them going into government with Sinn Féin, huge decision for the DUP, Stephen, except in the whole, the police and injustice thing, so many other things. Huge decisions for the DUP, huge political risks for them. They got their party over the line. But for some reason, they made a complete dog's dinner of the Irish language. They said, no, no, no. But it's impossible, Stephen, impossible to deny that in some form or other, they gave very clear impression to both governments and to Sinn Féin and to the smaller parties that they were willing to make some sort of significant move in Irish language. That was the key mistake. Yeah. They hadn't prepared their party.
And that's what someone from within the very heart of the DUP, Alex, was telling me very recently. Indeed, they were saying, actually, if you look at the draft of the Irish Language Act, of the Irish language agreements that were about to be made, that it wasn't that bad for unionism, that actually this person felt that the DUP negotiating team had done a really good deal. And yet, what they hadn't done was prepare their base. Something as basic as that, prepare the base. Meanwhile, this person said, you had Arlene Foster and the DUP saying there will never be an Irish Language Act. They knew that hinterland was there and they hadn't worked out a plan as to how to then introduce it.
Well, I find that extraordinary. As far back as last March, Stephen, I've done a number of articles and many programmes. I've said the same thing over and over again. What people said to me, you said to me, other journalists, Alex, are you not too pessimistic? And I said, no, over and over again, if you do not prepare your base for an Irish language, maybe not an act, but certainly for a significant, very substantial movement on the Irish language, which has to be included. If there's going to be a deal involving Sinn Féin, it has to be included. The DUP did absolutely nothing. It would have been easy enough, Stephen, because I have no particular animus against promotion and protection of the Irish language. It's a very important thing, not just for Sinn Féin or Republicans. It's part of our overall culture. Something needed to be done. I think the DUP and unionism collectively could have worked out and said, what's acceptable? What can we live with? What's important? How do we accommodate all of it? Sinn Féin could have done the same thing. Apart from Carol na Cuillin stuff and some of the Irish language lobby groups, Sinn Féin themselves could have said, look, here's the outline of a draft bill. This is what's important. And somewhere over those 13 months, Stephen, I'm pretty sure they could have come up with something. They didn't do any of it. They chose not to.
When you said, and Henry, I'm going to come to you in a second, I promise.
Yeah, no problem.
But Alex, when you say they could have done something, is it that complicated a thing for the DUP to have said publicly, look, we're in a negotiation and it may be the case that we're going to have to introduce something close to an Irish Language Act, something that people might feel is an Irish Language Act? Could they not have said it out loud?
Yes, and they should have. And again, Stephen, I said it months ago. Here was the situation. We knew from March onwards, we knew for 100% Sinn Féin had made it clear that they wanted significant movement on an Irish Language Act. That's what they said. There was room for manoeuvre. We've seen in other parts of the deal, Stephen, on same-sex marriage, on the petition of concern, on sustainability of the institutions, Sinn Féin did give way. Let us not ignore that fact. Sinn Féin did give way on some of those areas. But the DUP, knowing significant movement on the Irish language, was an essential ingredient. Should either say to Sinn Féin, we can't do this, we're not doing it, the talks are ending in March, thank you. Or they say to their people and their officers and their MLAs and their representatives, we are going to, and they did this, Stephen, they did this when they went into government at St Andrews with Sinn Féin. They had to do all of that. For some reason, which I don't entirely understand, they chose not to play the game and, that way this time.
And for the record, the DUP would maintain to this day that they had not and will not agree to an Irish Language Act, that that's not what they were doing.
But we don't know
in the draft papers. Well, Arlene Foster is back to saying that they will not agree to an Irish Language Act. So they're preparing the future for that. But you make a very good point, Alex. Had Sinn Féin prepared their base that they were going back on an election promise not to go back into an assembly without equal rights around gay marriage, around same-sex marriage? Had Sinn Féin prepared any of their base for that election promise, which clearly in that draft agreement it was not being fulfilled?
Stephen, this is the nature of agreements, not just in Northern Ireland, everywhere. Both sides, particularly when they're as far apart in major issues as the DUP and Sinn Féin, both sides know that movement, fudge, whatever you want to call it, is required. Their elected representatives know. Their negotiators know. The people who sit in the assembly and councils know. That's what I'm saying. I have no idea why, in this particular case, the DUP, who are usually brilliant at this, are much better than the LCUNIS party were doing this, usually brilliant. For some reason, I don't know whether it's an internal battle. I don't know whether it's an internal leadership versus a good. I don't know, Stephen, because there's so many country versions. I don't know. But one thing I do know, Stephen, you talk about Ireland keeps saying no Irish language, no this. There is a simple solution. So much of this is in the public domain. At some point, there must be an original paper from the DUP negotiators on what they were prepared to do and what they thought was acceptable on Irish language. You know, it might help the debate, Stephen. It might calm some unionist nerves as well. It might actually assuage some elements of republicanism who are very angry with the DUP if they could actually see what the DUP thought was negotiable. Because none of us have any idea. And that's why you'd never negotiate blind, Stephen, particularly with your own people. You can make, doesn't matter if the DUP make the Republicans angry. It doesn't matter if they make Alliance angry. It matters very much when they clearly make their own base angry. And their own base, not universally, but their own base in significant sections, I've talked to some of them, are angry, Stephen.
Henry Reilly, how much give do you think people from within the community, so not the negotiating teams, within the communities that live here, are prepared to give each other? How flexible are people prepared to be in order to get a deal, do you think?
Well, on the Irish language issue, Stephen, I agree with Alex. I read the document in full, the alleged draft document, and I didn't see anything in there. I thought the DUP had actually done a fairly good job. They had tamed the Sinn Féin aspirations and, negated the worst of it. But what happened on that instance, the DUP had been bringing people along fairly well. But whenever on the Sunday preceding, whenever Mary Lou was given the clenched vision, talking about up the rebels and Chuck Ní Ar Lá, and then the incessant radio interviews with Irish language activists saying, reaming off these really unreasonable demands. And in the unionist mindset then, they associated what the Irish language activists were demanding with what the DUP had agreed, even though clearly that was not the case. And then,
but the question also remains, where. So what happened was Conrad na Gaeilge came onto the Nolan Show. They were asked a question and they said that they wanted every street sign in Irish in Northern Ireland. Yeah. I repeated the question. I said, do you mean also up the Shankill, Conrad na Gaeilge? Yes. Then Pobble, they confirmed that they also wanted every street sign in Irish. So Stephen, here's a question. If that is not what Sinn Féin wanted, why was Sinn Féin not on the Nolan Show immediately saying, listen, that's not true?
Because Sinn Féin...
It took days.
Sinn Féin really had nothing very much to lose. And if you look at the salient point that has come out of Mary Lou MacDonald's mouth for me over the last number of weeks, what was, she said, Sinn Féin cannot afford to get comfortable in Stormont. Now, if they can't get comfortable with working with unionists and whatever, that just means endless agitation, endless unreasonable demands. And, unless we can get some form of government where people can agree on things and work together, this isn't going to work, Stephen. What we have there at the present time is not going to work. If you have a significant party like Sinn Féin that can't be comfortable in its political surroundings, then what's the future?
Well, of course, they would have a completely different version on that, wouldn't they? And would say that they've been working day and night to try to find a deal so that they can work with the DUP. Do you think the intent is now there, Alex, at the moment, for them to reach compromise with each other, or do you think, you know, this person within the DUP has told me this week that they reckon it's going to be a number of years, 2 to 5 years, before devolution will be restored, is what they said.
Stephen, it can't be 2 to 5 years and keep the pretense of the Good Friday Agreement. And this is another issue that's concerned me, as you know, over the past year or so. Do we, if we can't sustain government in Northern Ireland, if the institutions which are set up, and let's not forget the institutions were set up to promote progress and reconciliation, new era business in Northern Ireland, were put in to actually move us away from what had been considered the extremes to move us towards some new centre ground. None of that has happened. None of that is happening, Stephen. You cannot, for months, for years, say, oh, there's a Good Friday Agreement. Say, oh, everything's fine. But by the way, since you can't govern yourselves, yeah, we'll do it for you. And then the problem is Sinn Féin saying, well, no, it can't be direct rule. And even the DUP, oddly enough, not saying they want full-throated direct rule, because full-throated direct rule, Stephen, means closing the institutions and basically binning the Good Friday Agreement. So they both want this sort of limbo land where you pretend that, oh, it's, you know, we can still do this. Oh, would people still want to do that? You can't do that, Stephen. Some very difficult decisions now have to be made.
There's a lot of heat on the media at the moment and journalists at the moment, Alex. And I just wonder if these political parties are ever going to realise that whatever they call things, if a journalist is worth their salt, they're going to lift up the label and look what's underneath. That's what a journalist's job is to do. So whatever way they're trying to call these things, be it a culture act or whatever, the key question clearly is, what is the content of what they're agreeing?
Well, of course it is, Stephen, and it goes back to the... One of the things which I think has hugely damaged debate in Northern Ireland is the constructive ambiguity. And I can understand it was built in 25 years ago to allow both sides to say, well, look, it's not what you think, but we're doing the best. The hope being...
Does that work anymore, though?
No, that's what I'm saying, Stephen. The hope was, and I voted for the agreement on the basis that we needed constructive ambiguity, but over the succeeding, I hope, 10 years or so, by the time my Megan got to about 10 or 11, I hoped in that intervening time, we would have learned to trust each other, actually go, we can make common decisions on education and on the health service and on road, all the things that ordinary government, we can do that. We found we couldn't do that, Stephen. Constructive ambiguity became destructive clarity. And even now, we have people saying in this agreement, oh, no, that wasn't an Irish language. Like, oh, yes, it was. Oh, no, it wasn't. We cannot. Do you know something, Stephen? Maybe. Well, I think that people can shrug along for a little while and we don't have the violence, and thank God for that. What people want from the political parties, what their bases want as well, Stephen, it's ruthless honesty with each other. If you're going to negotiate with each other, then don't faff around.
But is it? But actually, many people might think they were being ruthlessly honest with each other. It's the message that was being given to the public. The pre-election promises, and then when they're negotiating, as we've discussed already, there was no preparation for the base of either of these two parties. That, look, you know, we might be changing that. We might be changing our promises. We might be doing that. There was none of that happened.
No, that's what I'm saying. The ruthless honesty, actually, I didn't just mean between the negotiators. I meant ruthless honesty with the parties. I think the DUP and Sinn Féin saying to the base is, look, this is the ideal utopian thing. We're not going to get that. This is the thing beyond which we cannot go. Somewhere in the middle, we can do this. They needed to say to each other publicly. They needed to say to their bases publicly.
Okay, here's Mervyn.
You cannot keep pretending that something is what it isn't, Stephen. That is just stupid.
Morning, Mervyn.
Good morning, Stephen. Are you well?
Yes, go ahead, Mervyn.
Stephen, can I ask Alex a question?
Of course you can.
Alex, good morning to you.
Good morning.
My concern is the last 13, 14 months is the state of unionism in Northern Ireland. I strongly believe, Alex, it's not in a good place. We have a lot of differences within it about gay marriage, homosexuality, the whole lot of it, the Irish language. But to me, Sinn Féin or hooliganism, whatever, seems to be strong in defending their corner. But within unionism, Alex, there's too much opinion. Too many people want to make a statement, and it seems that we're going nowhere. So I would put this question to you, as I did 6 months ago. Is it not time, Alex, that the likes of Robin Swan, Arlene Foster were to sit down and sort out unionism?
I didn't get your first name there.
Mervyn.
Mervyn, oddly enough, I'm working on the book at the minute. I remember looking back over some stuff. I've been writing articles about unionism and what it needs to do, how it needs to get its act together for 25 years, Mervyn. And one of the original pieces I wrote for the newsletter in 1979-80 was actually, you know, unionism, whether it's in small parties or collective parties, needs to say simply, what does it mean to be a unionist? What is the union? What are we protecting? How do we accommodate those who are not unionists? Those are issues. Even now, I think David McNary made the joke once, Mervyn, that if you brought all the unionist parties, this is going back 25 years, so if you brought all the unionist parties into a hotel in Portrush for a weekend conference on unity, and you said seven parties, you come back in the Sunday morning and there'd be nine parties, three offshoots and at least two mavericks.
Exactly.
The nature of unionism, which I don't entirely understand, Mervyn, but it explains our problem.
Henry Riley?
We constantly divide.
Henry?
Yeah, well, republicanism is no more efficient politically than unionism. But where republicans excel is in the way they can propaganda size.
Yep.
And if you look at the victims issue now, you know, the RUC were responsible for 0.4% of violent deaths, and that was terrorists and whatever. The British Army, 8.9%. The Republicans, combined republicanism was something like 70%. But yet they are trying to turn this around and create this narrative that they're the victims. As Alex said yesterday about the parade, or Chris said about the parade in Belfast, you know, you had leading Sinn Féin.
Yeah, you've missed out the loyalist paramilitary groups conveniently, Henry.
No, but what I'm saying is the way that Republicans never refer really to loyalist paramilitaries. They continually refer to the police and the army, and they say that they were the victims of this aggressive military campaign, state campaign, whereas that patently is not the case. So unionism has to get its act together and be able to counter the Republican narrative that's been developed that, okay, you know, unionism and the UK state authority.
Henry's right in one sense, but it's not just about countering the Republican narrative. That is important. It's also about explaining the unionist narrative, Henry.
I agree.
We spend more time, almost as much, and not only do we demonise Sinn Féin, which is fair enough, that's part of electoral politics, unionists quite often demonise each other as well. They come and say, you're a traitor, you're a Lundy, you're a sellout, and then expect unionists to come out with any degree of confidence. You need a clear, coherent narrative that unionists of all shades, and all shades, can actually understand what the four main facets of unionism are. That would make it so much easier to actually begin to encourage people back to the ballot box.
Jonathan's in Newton Arch. Morning, Jonathan.
Morning, Stephen. There, I've just listened to your programme there. I'm, as a unionist, I'm just disgusted that one party can bring down what a so-called government in Northern Ireland because of a language that really very few people speak. But the very fact is, nobody's asked this question: who's going to put all these signs up in loyalist areas, in unionist areas?
Well, of course, after you looked at the draft agreement that, according to some people in the DUP, wasn't even a draft, no draft existed. But after you looked at the pieces of paper which said draft on it, which Edwin Poots said he had a hand in writing, there was nothing in it about street signs in Irish.
Well, the public have heard otherwise.
But within the speculation at fever pitch that a deal was about to be done, why did the two Irish language groups, Conradh na Gaeilge and Pobble, come on the Nolan Show and say that's what they were demanding as part of that deal? Why did they do it?
Because they want to stir up trouble. They don't want it to work. Because it's not
obviously
going
they
to
would
work.
Deny that.
How
they would
is
say
it going to work?
Conradh na Gaeilge then rolled back from it a few days later and said it was all about consent. They didn't say it on day one, though. Why did they do that?
Well, they didn't have consent. They didn't have consent, and the DUP didn't agree with what the Irish bodies came out to say. I mean, at the end of the day, look, it's not going to happen. And unionists are really, in a way, really fed up listening about it. There's more important things in Northern Ireland like health, roads and education and jobs. That has to be number one priority. A language is not important.
Has any,
it's not
has
important.
Any,
it's
has
a
any,
political thing.
Has any unionist...
The way Sinn Féin's using, because do they really want a government?
Has any unionist actually asked Arlene Foster, why are you against an Irish Language Act? No matter what... Why is she against, Alex Kane, an Irish Language Act, no matter what's in it? Why is Arlene Foster not prepared? Could she not sell to their base an Irish Language Act, which maybe wasn't as tough, or maybe didn't have all of Sinn Féin's demands in it? Why is the whole label of an Irish Language Act so acceptable, unacceptable?
Because, Stephen, I think, yes, you say, could the DUP sell it? Yes, because I said to you earlier, look at what they were able to sell. Look at their position in 98, look at their position in 2007, look at their position in 2016. Yes, Stephen, they were capable and brilliantly capable of selling a great deal to the base. Much of it was important. I think the problem in all of this, it got to the stage where at one point it looked as though the DUP was not negotiating the Irish language with Sinn Féin. It was actually negotiating the Irish language with Conradh na Gaeilge, with Pobal and so on. And that's the message. What people heard, not only through the Carol na Cúilíne consultation stuff, which was not official draft white paper stuff, that's what unionists got. And non-unionists as well, Stephen, they got the feeling that what Conradh na Gaeilge, what Pobal and all were saying, that was going to be in an Irish language. Like, those are the demands. Look at the response of some of those groups to the what was in the draft paper. They were angry. They said it didn't go far enough. I think if Arlene was serious, and the negotiators knew, they knew that they had to find an accommodation on Irish language. They knew if they wanted devolution back, that was required. I do not, said it at the top of this interview, Stephen, I do not know why the DUP so firmly set their face against this to the extent that they didn't even whisper in the ears of key players, we might have to move on this. They should have done that, and they would have found, as in all negotiations, Stephen, in life, not just politics, it's so much easier to get something across the line if your people aren't surprised. You surprise people in any circumstance, Stephen. You cannot, in turn, be surprised when they react badly.
Here's that's Albert and Glengormley. Morning, Albert.
Morning, Stephen. Stephen, where unionism is concerned, basically is from 1998, they don't seem that they've got anything out of any deal. And if you take the likes of the Irish language, they see that as another nail in the coffin of their Britishness and Sinn Féin destroying our Britishness. Now, when it comes to the likes of unionism where the British government is concerned, you look at the Irish government rolling in behind Sinn Féin. Who is supporting? We had David Cameron and Theresa May saying, oh yes, we want Northern Ireland to stay within the United Kingdom and we'll support them all the way and all this kind of rhetoric. And they have done nothing to support basically this part of the United Kingdom. All they're doing is, and you've seen the...
Well, of course,
the
there's the £1 billion of funding that the DUP negotiated to prop up the Tory government, the vast majority of which we haven't seen yet, but apparently it's on its way.
But you only have to... They're deafened by their silence. They never come out and basically talk about basically that we will support them. And it's all right throwing money into it.
Okay, Albert, thank you. I'm just rushing on here.
We want them to basically come out and say that they're fully behind this part of the United Kingdom.
Albert, thank you. Colm Doerr has contacted the programme. Morning to you, Colm, the commentator. Morning to you.
Morning,
Stephen. Go ahead, Colm.
I was intrigued by your question about Pobal and Conradh na Gaeilge when you asked why they advocated for very comprehensive legislation. Is that not their role? Do advocacy groups in any area, health or anything else, do they not to advocate for the greatest possible legislation?
But in the context of Northern Ireland and knowing how delicate negotiations would be, did they seriously think that they were going to get their demand of Irish street signs going up in the Shankill? Like, is that realistic, or was it helpful for them to say that?
Well, in terms of street signs, Stephen, I would ask, why was the conversation focused on street signs on the Shankill or in housing estates? The conversation could equally well have begun in terms of putting signs on motorways like the M1. Why not start the conversation there? Why make the choice, because it is a choice, an editorial choice of that, to focus on housing estates? Why not ask, could we as a society bear Irish signs, bilingual signs on the M1?
Because it was a completely valid question, Colm, that when we were talking about all public services to facilitate the Irish language, it was a completely valid question to say, well, hold on a moment. And then we were talking about signs and road signs. It's a completely valid question to say, look, where does that stop? What about shared areas? Or what streets are they not in? But that's not what those two Irish language groups said.
But Stephen, why start with the question?
Pobl said, just to be clear, Pobl actually said that if there were... Pobl said, and I'm paraphrasing, but here's what they said. They said that if you didn't have every street sign also in Irish, that would create ghettoisation.
But Stephen, don't you have a choice to make about which end of the spectrum you start the conversation at? Instead of asking, where do these signs stop? How far do we go? Why not ask, what could we bear? Where could we start? Why not choose that end of the spectrum to start the conversation?
I've heard this and read this over recent days that, you know, the Nolan Show has got the blame for asking these questions. It is the role of this programme to ask questions, and then if the answers are revelatory or surprising, to follow that story. So the Nolan Show is not going to, and I said this the other day and I'll say it again, we are not going to sugarcoat or put jam on top of the division or the disagreement that is in Northern Ireland. Alex Kane?
On Colm's original point about, you know, is that not the role of Pobl and Conrig and so on to do it? Yes, it is, Colm, but the danger became, are they knock-on consequence which became dangerous, was that it began to look to many people on the unionist side that somehow the debate was no longer an Irish language, was no longer between the DUP and Sinn Féin. It was actually between the DUP and Conrad na Gaeilge and Pobl. And their agenda was not Sinn Féin's agenda in totality, and I think that's the problem. It spooked them, Colm. I've been around this long enough to know it's not only in unionism, it's astonishingly easy to spook one side or the other if people get the wrong end of the stick, and I think that's what happened.
Alex and Colm, thank you very much.